Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Steven Rodriguez, a PhD candidate in history at Vanderbilt University and a host on the network. Today I'll speak with Mira L. Siegelberg about her book, Statelessness, A Modern History, which will be released later this month by Harvard University Press. In her monograph, Siegelberg traces the history of the concept of statelessness in the years after the First and Second World Wars. At its core, this thoughtful monograph is an intellectual history of an idea that jurists in the United States and Europe struggled to agree upon after the fall of the traditional imperial ways of structuring belonging. Yet this book's methodologically pluralist approach also brings many other aspects of the problem of statelessness into focus, such as its implications on the global humanitarian crisis that followed these two conflicts, its resonances in particular ethnic communities, and the way it redefined many ideas about citizenship. Our conversation will run about 50 minutes. I'm speaking with Mira Siegelberg. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk with me today, Mira, about the new book.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Your book is in many ways kind of an intellectual genealogy of the idea of statelessness. But before we get into that aspect of the book, I wanted to just ask you about your own intellectual genealogy, how you came to the project, what sorts of questions were interesting to you as a graduate student, and how you ultimately decided to study this concept of statelessness.
Yeah, so just in brief, the book's a history of the concept of statelessness, statelessness in the sense of a person without a national status. And I'm interested in the book in understanding the intellectual and conceptual political origins of the legal frameworks that define what it means to be a citizen and also what it means to not be a citizen, to be a stateless person. But I mean, looking way backwards, I first became interested, I think, in the intellectual origins, in a really general sense, and the concepts and the categories that at the time when I became a more historically conscious person, that were defining normative debates about international politics, I guess in the extended post 9/11 moment, in the 2003 invasion of Iraq moment, when there were immediate political questions about the boundaries of international politics, which all seemed to me to have a particular moral and normative valence. And at the time, as an undergrad, I was studying with Sam Moyne and Mark Mazower, who were developing the innovative approaches to international history, drawing on the methods of intellectual history to explore in critical ways these normative concepts that were defining the way we argue about what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be a global citizen, the boundaries of sovereignty and international order. So I think I started thinking about these questions pretty early on in college. And I think, like many people in that extended moment, I also became interested in the tension between claims about universal rights and human rights and the continuing necessity, urgency, power of the state, and the tension between the idea that somehow we were getting beyond sovereignty and getting beyond the state, and yet the importance of citizenship still seemed to be quite obvious. So that's a puzzle that I think kind of drew me into doing a particular kind of history. And then I started thinking that I might be able to continue working on these themes in some way as a graduate student. I came across work by David Armitage, who described himself as working on international political thought. And I said, oh, maybe I can bring together my various questions and curiosities under this kind of broad heading. So I went into graduate school, you know, with not being particularly located in a place. I was roughly interested in the 20th century, but interested in how histories of international law and international political thought could be brought to bear to explain and clarify some of these more conceptual normative debates about the fundamental concepts of politics and international politics in particular. When I got to graduate school, international history had already exploded. But I think the project came together, like many projects, as a result of reading kind of eclectically, readings in political philosophy and legal theory, but also looking very carefully at international histories that were drawing on the history of international organizations like the League of Nations and the history of international law, not as sources for a kind of global future or sources for a more kind of idealist perspective on international relations, but as critical locations for the history of imperial and international order. And that if we wanted to grapple with the nature of global order, with the persistence of global hierarchies and domination, that it would be necessary to turn to the histories that had been for a very long time left out of diplomatic history and international history. I think there was also a kind of related move of historians who are working on the contingent emergence of a world of states out of a world of empires. And I was lucky to work with David Armitage at Harvard, who had been working on these questions, but also works by Lauren Benton and Frederick Cooper that made out a world of kind of, at least at the level of normativity, of sovereign equality, to show that that world was much more recent than historians had previously thought. And so when I was kind of developing my research topic, it seemed to me that the problem of mass displacement in the 20th century had to be looked at anew. And it had to be looked at from the perspective of how the entry of mass numbers of people without a national status shaped concepts and practices of sovereignty, rights, international authority. And that question seemed much more urgent in light of this new historiography and these new interpretations.
That's really helpful to know about your training, because I mean, I think the book is obviously hard, I think, in intellectual history, but you take a very pluralistic approach, as you kind of mentioned, your international history, diplomatic history, history of empire and law. And I think all of that comes out really clearly in the book and is done incredibly well. But I thought it might be helpful to focus on something that intellectual historians would like to focus on, which is kind of the genealogy of some of these terms or how they were debated at the time. So just to kind of name a few that came up as I was reading, you have terms like refugee, emigres, displaced person, exiles, the Heimatlos. What were the stakes involved in this kind of variety of terms? And how does statelessness fit into this the series of terms? How does it differ, and what were some of the kind of key debates during this time period that you cover in the book?
Yeah, so I think one of the vanishing points for the project, a central vanishing point for the project was always the eventual codification of the term statelessness in international conventions. There are two main conventions that define what it means to be a stateless person in international legal terms. There's a convention from 1954 and there's a convention from 1961. And of course, this legal definition always exists alongside and in tension with many different ways of using the concept of statelessness and invoking it. And just kind of intuitively, we know that we can invoke the term statelessness to mean a variety of things. It can mean groups that don't have a state. It can be a kind of all-encompassing term to describe people that don't belong politically without kind of appealing to a more specific codified legal definition that we find in a treaty. But my intuition was that by kind of tracing how this term came to be codified in a narrow legal sense, it would shed light on these kind of many different meanings. And in the process of writing that history, I was looking at how actors were making their own definitions and kind of making arguments for what it meant to be a stateless person in contrast to being a refugee. And how these more kind of specified legal categories emerged out of more literary or other kind of historical ways of describing what it means to not belong. But in the course of my research, I found this kind of key moment when legal scholars after the First World War identified the emergence of new vocabularies, new terms in English, in German, in French, to describe a person without a national status as a kind of key moment of historical transformation. So staatenlosen, stateless, apatrid, apolid, these are terms that begin to kind of emerge in legal and political writing after the First World War. And it's an actor's category in the sense that I'm not imposing a definition of statelessness. I'm interested in how these actors were themselves making these distinctions. And many of them describe this key moment of shift as a move away from the concept of Heimatlosen, which had existed already in international thought, to the rise of these new terms. And that has a kind of key pivotal point in the post-World War I rethinking of politics. So the distinction between those terms is really central to the story. And the book moves from the period after the First World War to the decades after the Second World War. And one of the key developments is the disentangling of the concept of being a refugee from the stateless person and how the creation of these two separate legal frameworks to define what it means to be a refugee as opposed to a stateless person was a deeply political process, but one that in order to make sense of, it's necessary to take into account the much longer history of how these categories were understood, but also the history of legal thought and law in general, and how the distinction came to be made between someone who still formally retains their national connection, but might need to flee as a result of persecution, which is a core part of the definition in the 1951 Refugee Convention. And then the codification of what it means to be a stateless person, which means that you don't have a national status in a formal sense. And so that division and that distinction is just critical to the story. And I argue that the ultimate marginalization of the problem of statelessness, which had been really central to thinking about a lot of the foundational political questions that come out of the post-World War I period, part of the process of marginalizing or stabilizing and neutralizing those explosive questions after the Second World War, a big part of that is how the distinction between what it means to be a refugee and a stateless person are disentangled.
One way I think that you show how this happens really well is you kind of combine you look at the kind of high level intellectual debates surrounding these terms, but then you talk a lot about how the League of Nations was kind of caught in the middle and ended up taking a sort of middle road, not wanting to intervene directly in these definitional issues and protection of people without the protection of a government, of their governments. And this put the League at odds with many thinkers who were interested in a more international approach to statelessness. Could you just speak a little bit about the League's position here?
Sure. The historiography on the League had just be kind of really blossomed when I was working on my dissertation, and because it was a sort of central location for thinking about international order, but also developing innovative, call it tools of international management and control, including the Nansen passport and new regimes of refugee protection, among other kinds of agencies that many people have already been exploring. But what I found in kind of reading the archives of the League in questions about refugees and stateless persons and the Nansen passport, and the kind of memos produced by the legal bureaucrats working at the League, when I read that their memos and archival materials alongside the legal writings that were produced after World War I on the question of statelessness, on the problem of statelessness, this really interesting tension emerged where the League was involved. Even if it wasn't the most powerful organization, even if it was limited in all kinds of ways, it did do a lot of innovative things in trying to reorganize the post-war world, in creating new kinds of international protections for minorities, for producing new forms of international protection for some categories of refugees. But when it came to the issue of dealing with people who had lost their national status mainly because the issues of sovereignty were so complex, with the dissolution of multinational empires and some new states that were emerging, some new states that didn't manage to emerge, and the problem of kind of governing empire and the mandates in general, the League was quite influential and powerful in the production of these new forms of international identification. And yet, when it came to the question of statelessness, the League acknowledged and recognized the question as being specifically a challenge to the boundary it was trying to, or the careful boundary that it was trying to maintain between the creation of new forms of international authority and the preservation of sovereign authority, on the other hand. So, read alongside the legal writings, which all emphasized the fact that a person without a national status had a particular connotation in the history of international legal thought, because to be a stateless person raised questions about the power of the state. It raised questions about the nature of rights. The kind of main issue was whether one as an individual had a direct connection or could be defined as a subject of international law. These were all kind of essential conceptual questions that got to the heart of the meaning of sovereignty and the meaning of international law and the limits of international law. And so the fact that the League understood the problem of statelessness as troubling this boundary that they were trying to maintain between their incursions into what had been traditionally the sovereign domains of states, and at the same time maintaining the limits of the organization, which itself served a constructive function in this flexible, contested moment when the question of what it meant to be a state, how new states emerge, what it means to be the subject of a new state. I mean, these are all kind of essential political questions that had existed in international thought before, but took on far more profound meanings in the post-World War I moment. And so the tentativeness of the League when it came to dealing with the problem of statelessness, I thought was incredibly illuminating.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's an excellent way to see, you know, how the rubber hits the road with a lot of these issues that had certainly been something discussed by jurists and legal thinkers, but not yet tested out. But I'm wondering, though, you know, obviously the literature on human rights and humanitarianism, one obvious criticism of that literature is that at times it could suggest almost a teleology of the triumph of this post-war period of or system of global governance and protection of rights. How do you see your book intervening on that literature? Do you see it complicating it, or is it a sort of corrective to these overly perhaps optimistic views of what happens in the post-war period with the creation of the United Nations, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think I'd say that it's that my book belongs broadly in this universe that you're describing, in that by the time I came to developing the project, I was already quite influenced by the more critical histories of human rights and humanitarianism, which set out to correct, as you describe it, these initially more, call it optimistic, but that looked at the emergence of global governance institutions and international institutions as a corrective, as a beneficial and idealistic corrective to exclusive forms of sovereignty and sovereign control. And this critical literature was interested in challenging that portrayal by challenging the teleology. So if we think about Sam Moyn's work on human rights, to question the idea of writing a history of human rights that isn't more attentive to contingency and disruption, but also the histories of humanitarianism that link up the emergence of non-state forms of legal and political authority to the history of empire and to the history of kind of great power control. So call those kind of more realist historical responses to an initially more sanguine, idealistic literature. I think when I started working on the project and as I kind of got into the dissertation and then the book, I just became convinced that the history of international law and the history of international organization was just central to international history, period. And that the work involved wasn't to kind of prove or disprove whether it was a good force or a bad force, but just to understand how it worked in the formation of the history of international order, and also in the history of the normative concepts that we've inherited, and how we debate those concepts like human rights or sovereignty or sovereign equality and self-determination. So, I mean, broadly, I think that's how I think about the book in relation to that literature. But it is making a more specific intervention in terms of, I guess, a more standard story about the post-World War II period and the emergence of individuals as the direct subjects of international law and the subjects of human rights. And I see the periodization that I'm presenting in the book and the argument that I'm presenting about how statelessness informs ideas about rights and legal personality and sovereignty and statehood after World War I forcing a different way of thinking about the significance of of the legal frameworks, the international legal frameworks that define what it means to be a refugee or a stateless person. And rather than thinking about those frameworks as the beginning of an attempt to define the individual as the subject of international law or the subject of human rights, to understand the post-World War II period as a period of stabilization and of different ways of domesticating these more kind of explosive foundational questions that that come out after the First World War. So it's taking a lot of the key terms from that those critical debates about the history of human rights and the history of humanitarianism, and using them to make sense of how the actors in the story were themselves trying to make sense of the problem of statelessness and the kind of foundational political questions that they linked statelessness to. Many of the legal scholars that write about statelessness after World War I and are advocating on behalf of people who don't have a national status are directly critical of international organizations. They're critical of the discourse of humanitarianism undermining the ways in which the recognition of statelessness as a kind of core problem of international order is itself a core political issue. It's not an issue to relegate to a kind of technical humanitarian organ of the League. And so these are kind of explicit terms of political debate in the interwar period, which in my research, I just found absolutely fascinating because it meant that the debates that more contemporary scholars were having between the politics of rights and the politics of humanitarianism were already part of an important discourse and field of debate in the early 20th century. And so that in itself, I think, forces us to think about these wider kind of conceptual terms that frame the literature.
On that note of the kind of political, how this was a political issue, I'd like to ask you about the geopolitical dynamics here. So obviously, the stakes of being stateless change constantly as, you know, the meaning of citizenship changes and more rights become associated with it. Obviously, the stakes become higher if you are a stateless person and cannot enjoy those rights. And obviously, one part of this is exclusion from those rights. People who are not accepted by any kind of, don't have any sense of national belonging or association that would entitle them to it. But I'm also wondering about the geopolitical use of inclusion. So including people who are stateless within national communities as a way of pursuing some kind of goal on the international stage. So just an example that I'm thinking of, that's something I'm familiar with, but perhaps there's an analog in your research, is just Mexico during the Cardenas years prided itself on accepting Spanish emigres fleeing the Franco regime. But this was not the case for the Jewish refugees who were in many cases turned down from being recognized as such in Mexico. So that to me is kind of this power of inclusion and exclusion both operating on a geopolitical stage here and both serving very specific kind of purposes. Do you see any of that in your book?
Yeah. I mean, I think the story of nationalization in the 20th century and how, not using it as a technical term, stateless people, refugees, diasporas are used in processes of state making, and nationalization is kind of a key part of the history, although it's not one that I go into much in the book. And I think after the Second World War, there's been a lot of great work on this subject of how rebuilding states or creating new states, how much of that isn't just a matter of being exclusionary, but also of kind of bringing in a kind of homecoming of people who are being kind of encompassed into the state or into the nation. I haven't focused on that because really my central question is about the history of the boundary between international and national forms of power and government and governance, and how those boundaries are negotiated. I think there's a lot of space, and I think a lot of the recent work on the history of statelessness is kind of coming at this angle of looking at how in a more bottom-up way the boundaries of states is really produced in a, you know, at the level of kind of bringing some populations in and excluding others. Because my focus is on the attempt to kind of define a common term, right? What do states mean? You know, how do we kind of define what it means to be a stateless person in common terms? And that in itself connects to a particular expectation of interstate order. What does it mean for one state to accept legislation put forward by another state about how they define their citizens or who's not a citizen? It's automatically an international question. It's really a problem of, I mean, it's a longstanding problem of international, of comparative law. How does one state kind of understand and interpret and accept how other states designate their subjects? And of course, there's bound to be conflicts over those definitions and interpretations. One part of the book deals with the international efforts to create shared agreements on this kind of comparative law question about how states define their subjects and how other states then accept or reject the terms of how people are being labeled. I talk about a much longer history of geopolitical or international conflicts over how governments or states label their subjects and how when people move around the world, those labels are bound to be contested. And throughout the 19th century and certainly even earlier, the questions of how one government understands the labeling of another, of how another government kind of defines and the limits of who's a citizen and who's a naturalized subject or who's an imperial subject, is a kind of key point of contention in diplomacy, in imperial politics, in international politics. But that by the end of the Second World War, these conventions and treaties do facilitate common terms and common understandings, which do minimize those questions as a kind of point of conflict between states. And so that's a big part of the story. But I don't think it excludes at all the questions that you ask about the various ways that governments consolidate their power, expand the boundaries of their populations by bringing some groups in and rejecting others.
We've been sort of talking around, I think, some of the your sources that you use, which I found really, from a methodological perspective, very interesting. I mean, you are not just using conventional legal sources, but incorporating some popular sources as well, such as novels. And I think this allows you to really do a very thorough sort of genealogy of some of these terms and the history of statelessness. But I was wondering, what was it like to kind of decide which types of sources would be privileged in which contexts? Because perhaps maybe there is a inclination, at least in doing kind of a traditional legal history, to go with the sources from kind of legal theorists and jurists. But you very nicely weave all of these sources together to give us a much richer picture. But I'm wondering what it was like to do this.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the question of selection, and even I think historians with the most highly developed methodologies will have to admit that there's there's a certain amount of art rather than science to how, to what seems to be relevant and what seems to be less relevant. I mean, I'd say that I was, I had particular events and particular cases that emerged out of my reading as really pivotal. So the first chapter really centers around one court case in an English high court from 1921. But as much as I'm trying to reconstruct that case and its reception, it's about kind of understanding the terms that the actors were using. And in order to make sense of those terms, I was trying to contextualize their meaning, which is, you know, not in the least a method that I adapted from intellectual history and the history of political thought. So the languages that are used, the concepts that are invoked for a particular reason, and they have a particular meaning in their time. And to find that meaning, I tried to kind of draw on, I mean, it is an eclectic array of sources that helped me kind of figure out what were concepts of statelessness, how were people using this term in the past. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit more promiscuous than some more orthodox ways of doing the history of political thought, because I am drawing on a variety of cultural sources to help make sense of it. But I wanted to understand why in the legal literature after World War I, the idea that there was something new about statelessness after the war. And one of the first sources that I came across is a treatise on the legal status of stateless persons by a legal scholar called I.G. Lipovano, who refers to statelessness as the question of questions. It's the question of questions because it gets at this kind of core issue of what it means to be the subject of law, what legal personality means, and whether an individual in the absence of the kind of mediating power of the state can be said to have a direct connection to international law. This is what this scholar described as this is the question of questions. But to make sense of that framing, I needed to look back to earlier legal treatises and then to kind of broader source base from newspapers and from novels, as you say, that mention this idea of the person of no nationality, the concept of the man without a country is this kind of key literary device that comes up again and again in a variety of places. So there just is an element of detective work, which really ends up being the most fun part of the project, of tracing footnotes, having intuitions about literary sources that might be relevant, and then kind of tracing the references that come out of the kind of key legal and political source material.
Well, I think one really fantastic part of the book in chapter 5, where the benefits of this methodological pluralism shines through is when you're talking about how military and international organizations invoke the term statelessness as this catch-all phrase. And in places like displaced person camps, officers and social workers essentially improvised and worked through a kind of a rough definition of statelessness and applied this in the kind of everyday, kind of these everyday bureaucratic settings. And so it's a moment where nicely, I think you see in the book where these high-level academic debates and juridical debates come together with kind of the day-to-day work of figuring this stuff out about what statelessness would actually mean in these very specific real-world contexts.
So, I mean, there's sort of two parts to that. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, language is flexible, and the usage of these categories in the context of kind of the DP camps of the 1940s, the post-World War II in the 1940s, shows the flexibility of language and these concepts and the way that language can be used strategically. And it it worked at that moment to use the term statelessness in this much broader sense. There were kind of political reasons not to kind of invoke more defined obligations to refugees. Statelessness was a kind of catch-all concept. And at the same time, it also spoke to a wider sense that existed in this kind of 1945, 1946 moment where the future of international order wasn't clear. I mean, the United Nations was, or at least the Charter for the United Nations already existed, but the future of empire, the future of post-war states, the future of the United States and the world, I mean, these were unsettled. And so the broad use of the term to describe refugees and people in DP camps spoke to that. At the same time, I'm also interested in the fact that outside what we might think of as kind of the high level intellectual debate, legal theory, that actors on the ground are also drawing on and invoking particular principles of international order. And that it's not just a question of in the moment management and administration and the strategic use of language, but that the use of these categories and that the way call them ground level actors are using these categories speaks to deeper issues and questions about the principles that define political order and international politics. So, I think there is a distinction between the kinds of sources that I'm using, and it is methodologically eclectic. But at the same time, one of the methodological points that I'm trying to make is that there's a give and take between the actors, kind of the more sort of strategic actors on the ground or in bureaucracies, and the higher level intellectual conceptual debates, because they both ultimately involve conceptual argument about things like what is the state, what does it mean to be a citizen, what is international order, and so we can find histories of political thought and international political thought in these plural and diverse source bases. That's one of the things that I think came out in the project.
Great. I'd like to turn to the end of the book when in the conclusion we're at the Soviet Union has fallen, and there's this sense that the era of states is over and this kind of thing, and you note that statelessness becomes less and less of a issue of it becomes less and less of a part of the discussion in terms of protection, protection of people who are find themselves stateless, partially because of this belief that we had reached an era in which states were no longer the kind of primary entity. And I thought a lot about the work of Charles Mayer and his book Once Within Borders, and just thinking about how much the stakes, as we were talking about before, have increased, that the stateless now are perhaps the most vulnerable, that there is this idea of, the cosmopolitans are ones who don't need to be anchored in any kind of place because they have the resources to kind of provide many of the services that others don't have and need to get from the state, whether it's kind of protection, social services, and things like this. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about that moment where you end the book, and also at the very end of the book, just you bring us up to the present moment, and it seems that a lot of these problems are not resolved, and the global pandemic, I think, has really shown that very clearly. So, could you just tell us about what ends up happening and where you end the book?
Sure. So, there's kind of two endpoints. I mean, there's the main narrative endpoint. Is really in the 1960s, before the conclusion, when the second convention on what it means to be a stateless person is agreed upon. And I'm trying to kind of map out how the creation of these conventions and the codification of what it means to be a stateless person is actually really important to understanding how the borders of kind of post-war, post-imperial states are created. And one of the things I'm arguing is that we really need to kind of trace the history of legal thought to make sense of the meaning of those conventions and to explain this phenomenon, which is kind of a key part of the literature on statelessness today, which is why does it become such a marginal issue? The 1940s and the post-war period is supposedly the moment when refugees and stateless persons become the subjects of international law. But what happens is that the problem of statelessness basically disappears in the legal literature. It disappears at the level of kind of the UN and international organizations. And one of the things I'm trying to show is that its disappearance isn't accidental. Its disappearance is connected to the ways that the new boundaries of states are legitimated and justified in the post-war era, and that the ways of thinking about the problem of statelessness as a problem, not just of being a stateless person, I mean, that it's a terrible predicament, but that it's a collective problem. It's a collective disorder that requires collective solutions. And that moment of conceptualizing the problem of statelessness in these terms goes away. And that marginalization is profoundly connected to how the category is eventually codified in these treaties and how that facilitates a kind of neutralization and domestication of the borders of belonging. So that's a central feature of kind of the endpoint. In the conclusion, I'm trying to kind of explain where we are now. And the post-Cold War moment, I think, brings out how the tension between the discourse of globalization, the discourse of kind of human rights, the discourse of a kind of emergence of a universal human subject, return statelessness to the center of kind of international legal thought and international politics, in a sense, in part because the dissolution of the kind of post the Soviet Union and other countries brings back issues of state succession and citizenship, which had been also central after the First World War, but also because of this puzzle that I mentioned in the beginning. I mean, the puzzle that Arendt identifies between the idea that one has rights by virtue of being a human being and the fact that that belonging to a state only seemed to be more necessary. And so the post-Cold War era is when the kind of problem of statelessness, I think, sort of returns to intellectual consciousness. And the book is trying to kind of explain the limits of how people understand that return. In terms of kind of bringing it up to the present, I mean, it's inevitable that when you start a project, you're going to be living through a very different moment from the one that you started with. And I think that's true for me, and it's probably true for everyone who's just finished a book. The world has changed dramatically. And I if there is a kind of normative point that I'm trying to make in the conclusion, it's that there are no kind of automatic and clear resources and that we can draw on from the earlier periods in the 20th century to apply to the accelerating crisis of mass migration, climate migration. But that we need to understand how a lot of the foundational questions and issues were stabilized and shut down in the post-World War II period as a feature of the creation of the post-war international order. And that we're inevitably going to have to face the more foundational questions about what it means to be a state, the foundations of states, what it means to belong to a state, that we're inevitably going to have to go back to those foundational questions. So if there is a project of recovery, it's to kind of recover the ways that that a variety of actors and institutions were involved in the shaping of this category and the shaping of the kind of boundaries of international order that in some ways pushed aside the foundational questions of political order that I think the problem of statelessness intrinsically introduces. So I'm trying to kind of get us back to that point, but of course in like a very highly contextualized, historicized narrative.
Great. We just have a few minutes left. So what I'd like to just ask, this is kind of customary here, about what you're currently working on. I know you just finished the book or just released, but what is the next project, and does it follow from this, or are you doing something different?
I mean, I have two kind of related projects that both come out of the research that I did for the book. An important part of the story is the history of this concept of legal personality and what it means to be the subject of law, and how the idea of being the subject of law changes a great deal. And one of the things I'm trying to argue is that transformation is pivotal to understanding the history of international order. It's why the history of political thought and intellectual history is central to how we do the history of international order. And so that kind of got me more interested in the history of this idea of kind of legal personality and corporate personality. And so I'm exploring a history of the concept of kind of corporate personhood from the 19th century onwards, as part of my interest in the history of legal thought. I didn't start out per se interested in the history of migration, but I inevitably became caught up in it in writing this book. It was impossible not to. So the other project that I'm pursuing is about the kind of twinned and histories of international law and political philosophy that comes out of the mass migration in the late 19th century, and the kind of twin developments of these two genealogies or two different kind of traditions or approaches to thinking about migration and global political order. So both certainly came out of the book and are connected to earlier questions, but also just kind of came out of new directions that just arose in the course of writing.
That sounds like some really fascinating projects. But we're out of time, so I just wanted to thank you again for chatting. It's very, I feel like I learned a lot and enjoyed discussing some of the ideas. And take care.
Thanks so much, Stephen.